So you're the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center, and you know more than a little bit about chimps as well as human communities. When you look at, for example, hunter-gatherers and the way they cooperate when they get some very valuable food versus looking at chimps, what do you see? What are the similarities? What are the differences in the way they share or don't share?
Well, chimps are hunters. They love meat. They only eat maybe 5% of their diet to 10% in meat, but it's their favorite food, clearly. They really love it. And chimpanzees have very rudimentary moves in the direction that humans have taken, if you want to look at it that way. When chimpanzees kill, let's say, a large colobus monkey or a baby bush pig, which is quite a bit of meat in either case, their sharing is very different from hunter-gatherers. A hunter-gatherer, when they make a kill, they actually make sure that a dominant male will not take over the kill or feel proprietary about it. And the way they make sure that he doesn't monopolize the meat and use it for his own political and also nutritional purposes is they put someone else in charge of dividing the meat up. Now, when a chimp kills, let's say, a baby bush buck, which would be a little antelope, if it's a high-ranking male who kills the animal, he'll preside over it, and he'll share with a few cronies, but not with everybody, and they're going to be a whole bunch of beggars, and the scene is just chaos, unless you understand what's going on, because the beggars are all fighting each other for position in line, and they're very unlikely to get anything at all, but they're so intent on the meat that they fight or quarrel. In the meanwhile, the dominant individual, who's either killed the animal or has confiscated it from a lower-ranking individual who's killed it, he gives some meat to his girlfriend, to his relatives, to his political ally, and basically shuts most of them out. So chimpanzee sharing is very different from human sharing. It does not have this idea of everyone in the group has a right to some meat.
It's interesting that you write about how there's basically a kind of enforced humility in some of the hunter-gatherer tribes that have been studied. In other words, if somebody says, I'm a great hunter, they get punished.
Absolutely. Hunter-gatherers are intent on two things. One is seeing that meat is shared equally, and the other is that political power is shared equally. And we're talking about the male hunters in the group. If they're female hunters, they would be probably counted as well. But often the females don't hunt. We call it egalitarianism. And egalitarianism means, in hunter-gatherer bands, that no male can become a dominant bully in the group. And not only that, but if any male makes a move in that direction, he's quickly put down. They're very preemptive in making sure that every male retains his full autonomy and no one bosses anyone else around.
It's interesting when you talk about the chimps just now and you talk about these hunter-gatherer societies, and let's say that they're not all exactly the same, but nevertheless, it's kind of like we see things in American and in highly unequal capitalist societies that kind of more resemble the chimps.
Well, absolutely. And we actually, an anthropologist named Bruce Knauf has talked about how political evolution has assumed the shape of a U-shaped curve. That is, high hierarchy at the beginning. The chimps are very, very hierarchical. Bonobos also are, a bit less so. Then, for many, many millions of years, presumably, we've lived as egalitarians, these hunter-gatherers. And especially for the last 250,000 years, we can be quite sure that we were egalitarian, because that's the only system that would work for large game hunting. And we know that large game hunting is phased in at a quarter of a million years ago. So up until about 12,000 years ago, the entire world was egalitarian. Equality ruled. And what happened with farmers was that they came to have higher population densities. They had greater needs for command and control. And although most of the farmers remain tribal and egalitarian even down to this day, a few of them developed chiefdoms and then kingdoms and then early civilizations. And at that point, our U-shaped curve goes way up again, and humanity is headed for a great deal of hierarchy. And interestingly enough, we have perhaps two types of society today in the world, one of which is democratic and one of which is autocratic, or whatever you want to call it, totalitarian. There are a lot of names for that other type. And basically, a democratic society is an attempt to make a hunter-gatherer egalitarian society out of a huge, huge society that needs a lot of command and control. And so what we've done, in effect, is to make our societies as egalitarian as they can be and still keep enough command and control to run the place. And that's why we have democracies with checks and balances, but we do have presidents and they do have armies at their command. But we also have very strict codes of individual rights and so forth. And this all reflects our egalitarian background. We're trying to do the same thing in a much larger society where it can't be done with a vengeance the way hunter-gatherers do it.
And it can't be done just because it's too big, it's too anonymous. I mean, the mechanisms that you describe in the book that hunter-gatherers use have to do with basically ganging up on each other and things that can be done in small groups where you can all see each other.
Yes, the hunter-gatherers actually do things by consensus. They never vote. They make all their decisions by consensus. And unless everyone agrees, they can't make a decision. A democracy couldn't afford that. And that's why we have voting by majority. And it's why we have, in theory at least, a loyal opposition. When the opposition is not loyal, as is very much the case in the United States today, then you get gridlock and the system doesn't work very well.
What do you mean by a loyal opposition?
A loyal opposition means that in a democracy you take a vote, and it's always assumed that there are rules to the game, and the rules are the majority is going to rule, and the minority is not going to go up in arms and start fighting, or even, hopefully, it won't be doing what's happening today in Congress, but rather it will work with the majority to achieve the decision. So the decision's made by a majority, but everyone's supposed to go along. And in a hunter-gatherer group, of course, with a consensus system, either everyone agrees on the decision in the first place or nothing happens at all.
And when that is witnessed, when you anthropologists who are in the field are witnessing that, does it take forever?
It's very interesting. One person will speak, then another person will speak, then a third person maybe, usually senior males, but sometimes females. And as the conversation goes along among group members, there's a feeling as to whether they're heading toward a consensus or not. And you can have opposition polemics along the way, but if these people are willing in the end to say, okay, I don't want to keep the group from making a decision, so I'll go along, then you've got a consensus. Consensus doesn't mean a perfect consensus. It means everyone in the group agrees with the majority decision, but everyone has to agree and get on board. So it's not that different from a voting situation, and yet it is at the same time.
In the hunter-gatherer societies that you know of, are there any that are egalitarian in terms of gender?
Of the type that existed a quarter of a million years ago, probably not, because those would be mobile hunter-gatherers who do not have any connection with agriculture, obviously, because it wasn't invented yet, and are economically independent. The most outstanding case of gender equality among hunter-gatherers is the Agta in the Philippines. These people kill wild animals and trade the meat with agriculturalists or horticulturalists who would not have existed prehistorically. And they trade back and forth so that they have mutual advantages, and we call this a symbiotic relationship. Unfortunately, the Agta can't be projected into prehistory because of this, but what actually happens with the Agta is very interesting. One of the favorite meat sources for the Agta is wild boar, one of the most dangerous animals to hunt that exists. Women go out in all women groups with dogs that turn the boars, and they spear them. They take children along, and if some of them watch for the kids while the others are hunting the most dangerous animal hunters ever go after, practically. And interestingly enough, this reflects in their everyday life. The women have very strong positions within the family, and they have a full voice in making group decisions, unlike most hunter-gatherers. Which has led me, although I haven't published on this, to think that it may be that it's the hunters, not the males, who have the main role in the groups, and that if women are full hunters, they're going to have a full political role. But unfortunately, we don't have many examples like this.
Very interesting. We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Let's talk about selection. This is something that you go into in the book. There's natural selection, there's social selection, there's what dog breeders do, which is a very specific kind of selection that goes into breeding animals of various, all domesticated kinds. Explain to us what you mean by social selection.
Well, natural selection is simply a blind process, which is basically what got us here and every other living being. And it simply means that you have gene pools and you have individuals, and the individuals are variable. And the more successful individuals are going to have their genes proliferate at a greater rate than the less successful individuals. Social selection is a bit more complicated, and it's only really seen strongly in humans. And here is one example of social selection. Hunter-gatherers have a profound distaste for bullying behavior because this encroaches on everyone's autonomy as a threat, at least as a potential threat. And therefore, they punish bullies mercilessly. Capital punishment is used. Also, ostracism, kick them out of the group. These have a telling effect on the reproductive success of the worst bullies. And we have to assume that whatever problems we have with bullying on the school ground today, they'd be a lot worse if it weren't for all the social selection that's taken place for at least hundreds of thousands of years.
So do you mean that people who were bullies 100,000 years ago, let's say some dude's a bully, by the time he gets to the age where he could marry or reproduce or whatever, he's not going to because he's been kicked out or shunned? No girl's going to have his kids?
Well, a bully might actually be attractive to somebody if he's powerful and a good hunter as well. So it's not exactly that the bully is going to be not chosen by individuals, but the group is going to kill him. And that's where he loses out reproductively. So it's really group punishment, and that is a form of social selection.
But it's only social selection if the guy actually gets killed.
Well, no, if he's ostracized, he's then denied cooperative relationships that are important to his subsistence, and that's going to cut down his reproductive success a little. And all these things add up. So it isn't just execution, but also other kinds of punishment. If the group shuns him because he's a bully, and this would be done in the ultimate form by actually deserting him or kicking him out, then he's off on his own and another group may not want him. So again, his genes are not going to prosper.
Is there a gene for altruism? Is there a gene for bullying? Is there a gene for somebody who's a psychopath?
To the extent that we can find physical anomalies that associate with psychopathy, the answer is yes. We don't know the genes, but we do know that the paralimbic portion of the brain, where emotions originate to a great extent, are anomalous in psychopaths. And therefore, we must assume that this has to do with genetics. But genetics just hasn't reached the point where we can talk about a behavior gene that we've identified for this or that. There are very few behavior genes.
So we assume that there might be a kind of altruism gene, but we can't point to it.
Or a bunch of genes that contribute to altruism and maybe do other jobs as well, in which case we have a tangled mess, which it'll probably take 20, 30 years to sort out.
Which isn't all that long.
Oh, no, not at all.
Now, what are free riders?
Well, when we get back to the problem of altruists and why altruists don't stick around in theory, even though we've got them going to blood banks every day, the free rider is the main problem. And the free rider has been conceptualized by a famous biologist named George Williams as a cheater. The free rider is someone who will see an altruist and instinctively know how to take advantage. That is, get the altruist to give stuff to me, but I don't give it back. In which case, free-riding genes should swamp altruistic genes, and pretty soon there are almost no altruistic genes in the gene pool. Again, our problem is, why is it that people give blood anonymously, adopt children in Africa, respond to Sally Struthers imploring TV spots and so forth? And believe me, Sally Struthers is an expert in bringing out the altruism in people. That's why people are spending money to have her on TV, or used to. So the free rider has always been a cheater. And what I introduce in my book is the idea that bullies are probably more serious free riders than cheaters. A cheater, all you got to do is, if an altruist develops a cheater detection capacity, which is the next logical step when you have this competition going on, altruists should be able to spot a free rider and avoid him. They can avoid a bully. It doesn't matter whether you can spot the bully or not. The bully's there and he's got force. So getting rid of bullies through groups that formed moral codes against bullying, well, they also punish cheaters. So groups punish cheaters, and they also punish bullies. And in the case of the cheater, individuals also can watch out for them because they're able to spot a cheater. In the case of the bullies, they really have to get together and put the bully down. And that's what is done through social selection. Now, there's a second type of social selection that I can talk about, and that is reputational selection. And here's how it works. A person is known as an altruist. Another person is known as being highly selfish. Who is going to be chosen as a marriage partner? Who is going to be chosen as a partner in subsistence if you're going out hunting or gathering? It's going to be the altruist. Now, it's more complicated than that, because the altruist will tend to choose other altruists, either as marriage partners or as subsistence partners in a hunting band. And the leftovers, which are the selfish guys, are going to have to be stuck with each other. And if you look at the cooperative dynamics between a pair of altruists and a pair of selfish free riders, the altruists are going to do much better because they're much better cooperators. So this is the second type of social selection. So one is punitive and done by the group, and the other is done through group choice.
This assumes monogamy.
Monogamy has never been a huge human trait, even though theoretical monogamous marriage is universal. You just have to look at some slippage, and there are also cheater detection mechanisms by which spouses try to keep track of each other. Groups also may punish serious adulterers. It's variable by different hunter-gatherer bands, but some of them punish adultery severely, some of them wink at it. But overall, adultery is not a total free ride. It does have consequences.
We are beginning to understand what groups get out of being made up of altruists. What do individuals get from being altruistic? What benefit is there for them?
An altruist, as an individual, gets chosen as a marriage partner, as a subsistence partner, sometimes as a leader. Leaders in hunting bands are supposed to be very humble and generous. Generosity is a huge part of it. So a generous person gives some stuff away, but then when that generous person has hard times, the people who have been given things by the generous person are going to reciprocate. And so if you're snake bit and you can't make a living, or you're sick or injured, if you've been generous in the past, it may save your life. So the net value of your generosity is huge, even though it cost you something along the way.
We're talking to Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins: The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame.